Due to the themes of this podcast, listener discretion is advised. Lock your doors. Close the blinds. Change your passwords. This is Secrets and Spies. Secrets and Spies is a podcast that dives into the world of espionage, terrorism, geopolitics, and intrigue. This episode is presented by Matt Fulton and produced by Chris Carr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Secrets and Spies. On today's episode, I'm joined again by Philip Smythe, one of the leading researchers of Iranian-backed militia groups in the Middle East. This time, we discuss last month's exchange of missiles, drones, and airstrikes between Israel and Iran. Philip helps unpack what triggered this latest cycle of violence, gauge Iran's intent behind launching an unprecedented attack against Israel itself, and look ahead at how it may impact the war in Gaza and the wider conflict throughout the region. Before we begin, if you're enjoying this podcast, please consider supporting us directly by becoming a Patreon subscriber. All you need to do is go to patreon.com/secretsandspies. Depending on which level you choose, you'll get either a free coaster or a coffee cup, and you'll also get access to our Patreon-exclusive show, Extra Shot, which comes out immediately following each new Espresso Martini episode. Your generosity is much appreciated and helps keep this podcast going. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy our conversation.
The opinions expressed by guests on Secrets and Spies do not necessarily represent those of the producers and sponsors of this podcast.
Okay, Philip Smythe, welcome back to Secrets and Spies, my friend. It's always good to have you on.
You had me again. I'm shocked.
This is your fourth time on, yeah. I think, since October 7th alone.
It's nice to know that I'm better than all of your other guests. I mean, I don't tell anyone that. A lot of people tell me that, you know, but it's okay. I mean, I accept it.
Well, one more time, I got to get that five-timer jacket for you.
that's
coming up soon. Yeah. You've been sort of our go-to guy here for all things Iranian proxies and all that since the war in Gaza started back in October. For anyone who has missed those episodes with you, just tell us briefly, if you could, your background, what you kind of study, that stuff.
Okay. I specialize in kind of focusing on Iranian proxy groups, and that goes for Shia militias that they might coordinate and control. They're in Iraq, Bahrain, Syria, Lebanon. Lebanese Hezbollah is a good example. Other groups like the Palestinian organizations, Hamas could technically be considered an Iranian proxy, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, kind of same vein. But it's organizations like that. It's interesting, like a lot of people think Iran proxy and they think just Shia militias. Well, I actually really enjoy studying Shia militias and I really specialized in them. But Iranian proxies come in all sorts of different shapes, sizes, and flavors, and sometimes they don't even fit the sectarian model of Iran. But I generally focus on them, kind of their politics, military strategy, kind of how they're built up, how Iran utilizes them. And I've been doing that for the past 15 years now. And I've had fellowships at the Washington Institute, worked with the Atlantic Council, been at University of Maryland. I've written a number of monographs and different articles on that subject matter.
Thank you for that. I asked you to come back on, of course, to talk about the last month or so of this kind of tit-for-tat cycle of exchanges between Israel and Iran directly for the first time. Well, I say sort of directly in quotations, and we'll get into that more in a bit. So as we have in past episodes here, I'll give a quick rundown of the events, what happened, and then we can, you know, get into some of the details here and start digging through it. Sound good?
That works for me.
So on April 1st, the IDF launched an airstrike on an annex next door to the Iranian embassy in Damascus. Some sources have described the annex as a consulate. Others claimed it was an apartment building for embassy staff, I believe. The distinction is a bit fuzzy, but it was an Iranian-owned diplomatic facility. 16 people were killed, including IRGC Quds Force Brigadier General Mohammad Zahedi, his deputy, and five other Iranian officials. The New York Times reported that they were meeting there with Palestinian Islamic Jihad leaders to discuss the war in Gaza. This followed several other strikes targeting senior IRGC officers in Syria since October 7th. About 2 weeks later, on October 13th, Iran retaliated with a long-range standoff attack launched from within Iran against Israel directly. In all, they sent up about 170 one-way kamikaze drones, 30 cruise missiles, and 120 ballistic missiles. According to Iran's chief of staff, the primary targets were Nevatim Air Base, from which the IDF launched the airstrike on the consulate, and a unit 8200 SIGINT post on Mount Hermon that supplied intelligence for the strike. Other targets were located near Tel Aviv and in the Negev Desert. Israel then activated its missile defense network, including the Arrow-3 and David Sling systems, to intercept the objects. U.S., British, French, and Jordanian forces in the region likewise sortied to prevent the bulk of the attack from even reaching Israeli airspace. The Saudis and Emiratis potentially had some offensive role here, but it seems at least they shared radar tracking data with CENTCOM. CENTCOM reported that their forces alone shot down 80 Iranian weapons over the course of the attack. By the end of the night, only 5 ballistic missiles struck Nevatim airbase, causing minor damage to a runway, and a 7-year-old Israeli Bedouin girl was seriously injured by falling shrapnel. Iran's UN ambassador claimed then that the matter could be deemed concluded, but nevertheless, the Israeli war cabinet vowed to respond. Then on April 19th, IDF aircraft operating from outside Iranian airspace, we think probably their new F-35s, destroyed a SAM battery guarding the Natanz nuclear facility near Isfahan. Other mysterious explosions were reported in Iraq and Syria, but not confirmed to be connected to the Israeli attack, at least as far as I've seen. Maybe we can talk about that a bit more later. Iranian officials in public statements directed both domestically and internationally quickly downplayed the strikes, denying that any damage had occurred. An IDF spokesperson declined to comment on them at all. And now here we are, about a month later from the initial strike that sort of caused this spiral. So, Philip, going back here to the start, I guess, could you tell us who was Mohammad Zahedi? What did he do?
Sure. So he was a really leading IRGC QF commander, QF meaning the Quds Force. Quds Force oversees the external operations for the Iranians via the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. And, you know, there were some interesting reports that were both in Persian media and Arabic media, and then it kind of dripped into English language media. That he may have even had a seat on the Shura, or the kind of the council for Lebanese Hezbollah. They have an internal council, and he was probably set up with their Jihad committee that deals with kind of the military affairs, like their Islamic they have an Islamic resistance and Jihad committee. And I mean, there's some who've written about Lebanese Hezbollah that they're two separate ones. And then there's other people who've said, no, they're joined. But he most likely had some form of a seat at the table when it came to Lebanese Hezbollah. You could see that by the people who actually attended his funeral, Nabil Kaouk, who was the commander for Lebanese Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. And he was this for like a decade and a half, probably longer than that. And he's held a number of really key positions within Lebanese Hezbollah, a real power player in the south. He was right front row for that one. And that usually is a certain sign if you're doing kind of, you know, Iran Kremlinology and you're trying to analyze how they've set the people up, then it tends to say that. But then beyond that, he was another one of those key nodes that was set up around the same time as Qasem Soleimani was kind of rising through the ranks of the IRGC QF, Qasem Soleimani being the commander who was killed in early 2020, along with his aide, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, who was an Iraqi Shia militia commander. But, you know, he was one of these key guys, these key nodes in the IRGC QF that not only maintained some level of control, but it was also kind of a command influence. So a positive influence in a way where he would deliver for some of these proxy groups. Like, for instance, you mentioned Palestinian Islamic Jihad may have been having a meeting there. Interestingly, some of the earliest reports to come out claimed that the one of the leaders, Assyrian leaders for the PIJ, was actually killed in that attack. There was no real evidence that really came out of that. But I mean, that would be kind of part and parcel. If you're trying to get the Iranian war plan together when it comes to what's going on in Gaza, how that involves Lebanon, how it may even involve the Houthis, aka Ansar Allah, in Yemen, you would have a meeting like that. Same thing goes with, you know, what are you doing on the Golan front? How are you sending guys over? It's important to note that, you know, PIJ, Hamas, a lot of other factions that are associated with Lebanese Hezbollah, including Lebanese Hezbollah, have also been launching a ton of attacks from southern Lebanon into Israel. Rocket attacks, you'll see Palestinian fighters, PIJ has lost a number of them that have tried to cross the border and attack the Israelis. Interestingly enough, they'll always take these kind of propaganda pictures for kind of the post-facto martyrdom pictures. And interestingly, they're always holding Iranian-made submachine guns and rifles as a little kind of hint, hint, hey, here's who supplies us. So again, it wouldn't be, it's not even just that he's kind of issuing orders. The way that they're meeting up, it's think of it as them trying to get together and come to a cohesive plan sometimes. Other times it's to rein them in. At other times it's to deconflict because sometimes factions have many, many different issues. But he was, you know, again, he was also kind of a key influence person when it came to Iran's campaign to essentially retake Syria for Bashar al-Assad and to really impose more control by Iranian-controlled factions that were there. So he had his finger in pretty much every pie. And given he was a senior commander, but again, even more in the shadows than Qasem Soleimani, the so-called shadow commander, you know, it's interesting. There wasn't as much known about him compared to, say, Soleimani, even in certain analytical circles. Because you could kind of see where the drip, drip, drip of certain pieces of information. I mean, you'd see the name before if you're kind of in certain spheres, looking at what's going on with IRGC-QF or looking at Syria. There were little blurbs that would pop up every once in a while in IRGC media. But it was interesting what was being dripped out, probably by, you know, intelligence sources or whatever, in the newspapers. Oh, and all of a sudden, you know, and he was also doing logistics for this. Where would that come from? Because I know it wasn't open source. But I mean, he had a very, very interesting background. And it was interestingly unveiled when it came into the news who was killed. And I think it's important to remember, it wasn't just this commander. You also had two other senior IRGC commanders. You're talking about kind of the full deck of rather important people who are not mid-level, they're senior, who are running affairs in Syria, in Lebanon, dealing with Palestinian issues, deconflicting and running the show in pretty much the Levant. And these are old hands. The, you know, the IRGC doesn't just produce commanders like this who've been on job for decades and really have close personal relationships with different commanders. This was one of the issues when Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis were killed because it caused some dissension in the ranks. There were some other issues. And so when you lose somebody like that who's key, then it's a big deal. And I do want to add to this. The Iranians themselves, now you could read this a few ways. The Iranians themselves said that he was a key planning node when it came to the October 7th attacks. And I would fundamentally agree with that assessment, but you could read it a few different ways. Maybe it's the Iranians thumbing their noses at the Israelis and say, yeah, we had a much bigger role than we actually had. I know that there's some analysts that would take that position. Frankly, I think the information that's there actually demonstrates that there was a hell of a lot more planning and organization that was done by the Iranians, not just of the Palestinian factions, but when it comes to media training and a whole bevy of different subjects. And a person like him would have actually been, again, like that kind of key person in there who's kind of handling these issues and forming them into a more effective, I guess, more effective ranks, having partnerships work, allowing different groups to kind of bloom in Gaza. And we could see that. And he was, you know, quite expert at doing that. You could see his work in Syria, how many little kind of Hezbollah copies started sprouting up all over Syria, whether they were, you know, run by Alawis or other Shia that were there or tribal groups. And in Gaza, I mean, you could see kind of the replication of that, where certain factions that really had, and I actually wrote about this in December for West Point's CTC Sentinel, their Combating Terrorism Center, but there were groups that really were kind of on the outs when it came to much influence in Gaza, both militarily and politically, because it was Hamas controlled. But magically, they were kind of allowed to sprout up again and kind of do what they wanted to when they were there, clearly demonstrating that, you know, Hamas and the Iranians kind of cut a deal. Hey, you know, you can let some of your factions grow and that'll be fine. But it was interesting what was allowed to kind of sprout up and kind of the media profiles they attained. You know, one of these groups, the PFLP-GC, was, you know, really cut to pieces during the Syrian war. And then beyond that was extraordinarily unpopular in the Palestinian territories. Ahmed Jibril, who was their old leader, probably got his rocks off more to killing fellow Palestinians than he did killing Israelis, and also the effectiveness of the group, given they're pretty much locked into, unless Hezbollah lets them do something, in Lebanon, locked into certain refugee camps or training bases out in the Bakaa. And then all of a sudden, you know, they went from only being able to execute like a few shooting attacks or maybe like some rinky-dink rocket attack to having rockets, recruiting fighters. They have new uniforms. They have new rifles. The Hamas is allowing them to kind of do different things in Gaza. That just doesn't happen by chance. There's clearly a deconfliction and some allowance for it to grow. And kind of going back at where the IRGCQF is and where certain key commanders were influencing it, you need figures like that to allow for that growth, to allow for the partnerships to kind of blossom, and then also allow for what essentially functioned as kind of a quasi-umbrella group to really exist.
Yeah, thank you for that. It's been described that this strike sort of was essentially a decapitation of the IRGC's kind of command and control network in the Levant, as you said, so spanning Lebanon and Syria. Was this more so a target of opportunity for the Israelis? I mean, they got the intelligence that Zahedi and these senior people were in one place at one time. Okay, let's take this gift and get rid of them. Or have you heard anything to the extent that maybe there was some sort of operational planning effort underway in that meeting that the Israelis decided, okay, we have to act on this now?
Well, I'm sure there was some level of operational planning and organization, because when you have that many senior commanders and you're also having people from a variety of different groups, again, reports were like PIJ, maybe there was a Hamas guy, maybe there was a few Assad people, maybe there were Lebanese Hezbollah that were there. It's not one of those kinds of meetings that really comes around all that often if you have intelligence for it to go and attack. So I'm sure something was possibly, you know, whether it was in planning stages or maybe it was deconfliction, who knows? I mean, I haven't seen evidence one way or another to say, oh no, they were planning the next big attack. I mean, it's unfortunately the position I'm sitting in doesn't really allow for me to know it. But what I would say is, in terms of it being a quote unquote target of opportunity, if you're having that many planners, that many influential, important people in the same room, and I'm the Israelis, it's a hard target to pass up, because it will offer some level of degradation to their kind of systems for planning, how they're kind of executing their business in the area. And I think, you know, it's hard for a lot of people in the West to understand this, but the way the Iranians operate, it's often kind of based on the personality of one guy, one commander who's really doing the hard work. And I'm not saying that doesn't mean they don't have their surrogates or that they don't have, you know, an effective network of people. They do. But often, and you saw this with Qasem Soleimani, you know, his personality helped really lead the day. And he needed to put lieutenants in place that could effectively execute his operations, what he wanted, had a good operational relationship with guys on the ground. I mean, that's how you build any kind of core network and then, you know, construct from there. I mean, a classic example of this, you can see this in Iraq, where there are IRGC commanders in certain areas that will like ride around in a car or a motorbike and deconflict when it comes to, you know, like criminal networks that are going out there that just happen to be associated with Shia militias that they control. So often it comes down to that. They are essentially operating as the representatives for Iran on the ground. Iran doesn't have the capability to send, 50,000, Iranians over there. So what do? You send, some kind of key nodes to get the job done. So looking at that in terms of what one could see in post-2020, let's say Iraq as an example, what happened after Mohandas and after Soleimani were killed, there were issues within the militia networks themselves. You know, sometimes they wanted to execute more attacks. Other times they would have certain conflicts with the Iranians or not listen to them. Maybe they didn't like, Ismail Ghani, the new commander of it, for whatever reason. Maybe they missed Soleimani and expected a greater response from the Americans. Maybe they tried to capitalize off of that for their own ends. You get moves like that. Now, if I'm dealing with the Iranians who are now trying to run not just Lebanese Hezbollah, their crown jewel, the jewel in the crown for them, like the biggest of the proxies, meaning the best for them. But you're now having an issue where the Palestinians, which really took a while for them to cultivate, and this is often forgotten, Hamas and Iran had some huge issues going all the way back to the Syrian war. PIJ, even Palestinian Islamic Jihad, even though they've had a very, very close relationship with Iran, also had their issues. And sometimes it was over relatively minor things, where the Iranians went so far, and I did write this in that West Point piece, they used a sticks and carrots technique, where Hamas realized that, you know, while they may be getting money from Qatar and support and everything else, it's still not the same support that the Iranians bring. And when the Iranians cut their funding, boy, does that hurt the group. You cannot pay, you know, your lower functionaries. You can't, you know, get those rocket facilities up and rolling. It changed quite a bit within that organization. Within PIJ, there's a classic example where PIJ didn't come out and support the Houthis when they were launching rockets at the Saudis, rockets and missiles, UAVs and stuff. And the Iranians said, well, it's a shame that you didn't listen to us. We're going to have to cut funding now. And you know what we're also going to do? We're going to start a splinter proxy group to really counter both you and Hamas. We realize it's not going to be that strong and it's pretty small, but it's going to annoy you and you're going to have to deal with it. So, you know, imagine this. This is all kind of going on in the background. And so, you know, a hit like that in terms of taking away certain operational and kind of other capabilities, strategic capabilities is, you know, it's quite a move.
I found that somewhat interesting. And now that you sort of just mentioned Hamas, it jogged my memory on this. But I found it interesting that PIJ people were cited as being in the meeting, at least one Hezbollah advisor that I understand, but no one from Hamas, at least that I've seen, you know, stated anywhere being there. Does that say something to you about the dynamic on the ground between these jihadist groups in Gaza? Is it weird that Hamas was left out, if they were?
I mean, if they were, I don't think it necessitates that there's another deeper issue or some other problem. I just think, you know, PIJ has a markedly closer relationship with Tehran than Hamas right. does. But then beyond that, if you're looking at a lot of the PIJ operations that were being run out of southern Lebanon, some of them were claiming that they were part of PIJ Syria, meaning they were recruited from Islamic Jihad people in Syria, probably from Palestinian camps, like neighborhood cum camps that exist there. That could be one thing. I mean, also PIJ, because they have that markedly closer relationship, if there's an issue and they're trying to work things together with, you know, Hezbollah and with Iran, who knows how they're coming into it as a deconfliction mechanism, maybe with Hamas. There could be a variety of different things. I mean, I think it's kind of like, it's like throwing confetti up in the air and, you know, try to find the red pieces. I mean, I don't want to say, don't want to lead from a conclusion backwards in search of facts, but I mean, it doesn't strike me that that's the reason that was happening. Again, I don't have any signals intelligence or anything on that one.
Yeah.
But I mean, it seems like this would be kind of a normal high level meeting that would occur with some main proxies where the Iranians have a lot of influence with them and there might be some strategic planning going forward. But again, that doesn't mean, I think, I don't want to get people confused in terms of issues that happen amongst Iran's proxies. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of like heavy detail and a lot of stuff, but that doesn't always mean that there isn't, you know, kind of a good working relationship. And we can see this again in other ways. You know, Hamas is an outgrowth of Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood and has a lot of close links with them. However, you'll also notice there's a lot of other overlaps that Hezbollah also has with Muslim Brotherhood factions. There were issues with certain Syrian Muslim Brotherhood factions when they were fighting Bashar al-Assad. Remember, Hamas actually went over, you know, and sympathized with them, sympathized with Mohamed Morsi when he was saying anti-Assad stuff and saying more sectarian things when he was elected president in Egypt. So, you know, there's an ebb and flow that kind of happens there, but to take it to the more contemporary times, right now, Lebanese Hezbollah is dealing with, you know, saying that they're castrated would be incorrect, but saying there's a weakened kind of Muslim Brotherhood network of sorts in certain places. And with that weakness doesn't necessitate that they can't operate, doesn't necessitate that they're not, you know, trying to pull their own political moves. But in places like Lebanon, in places like Syria, you will get different factions. The primary faction in Lebanon, which is Jamaat al-Islamiyya, they've been fielding troops to fight, you know, the Israelis. They are fighting alongside with Lebanese Hezbollah. They have a much closer working relationship. And again, a lot of that comes from, you know, practice over time. The Syrian war is now kind of considered yesterday's news, even though it's still ongoing. And you have these groups trying to attain some level of presence. And you also have groups like Lebanese Hezbollah and the Iranians, you know, they don't want to make this look like it's a Shia-only affair. They did that in Syria, and it really harmed them when it came to their Sunni proxies, Sunni allies, you name it, because those were few and far between. They're pretty blatant in their Shia sectarian interests. So, you know, how do you put a nice veneer on this? Well, we need those Sunni Muslim groups that look like this is more of a pan-Islamic effort. That's always been kind of an Iran thing. But anyway, I'm like getting ahead of myself on kind of the in the weed stuff, but the in the weed stuff, you know, I think it translates out to you'll have, I think it's hard for us to see within an opaque kind of operating system. It's very, very tough. And you can kind of only see the shadows on the wall, you know, Plato's shadows on the wall when you're looking inside the cave. But I mean, what I would make the argument of, I think the issues between Hamas and Iran, clearly Hamas is not a fully controlled, and I mean 100% controlled, you know, like Kataib Hezbollah in Iraq. They're not a fully controlled entity by the Iranians, but the Iranians have kind of a good modus vivendi or kind of working relationship with them. And frankly, I mean, this is now out of necessity too. It doesn't mean that certain things haven't boiled to the surface. I mean, you look at, you know, Hamas was saying, okay, when's Lebanese Hezbollah going to attack? You know, it's interesting talking about this, the missile attacks and the drone attacks and everything else that occurred. It's interesting. People were talking about, you know, kind of the escalation and what's the red line for Hezbollah? What's the red line for the Iranians? And, you know, they were missing a few things because no one was looking back to 2006. And I think it's interesting when you look at this in concert with what's kind of going on now. In 2006, you had Hamas pretty much take over Gaza. You had the Israelis who were going to invade in, and Nasrallah got out there and said, hey, you know, if this goes too far, you know, Hezbollah will become activated. Well, what did Hezbollah do? It literally started a war on the northern border with the Israelis. I mean, that devolved into a huge conflict. And so there's a possibility of Hamas going, okay, well, we made nice with the Iranians. Now we're kind of expecting that, you know, maybe we're going to get some help because you guys are also promising a big game. And I think in a way that kind of translated out into what happened with the Iranian response to the Israeli strike on the building next to the consulate. You know, I think in part they demonstrated time and time again, one, a level of weakness that too many people were commenting on. You know, Hezbollah was what? Sniping at some control towers, what are they called? Like electronics monitoring towers in northern Israel.
The cameras and stuff.
It didn't mean they weren't attacking. I mean, I don't want to underplay that, but it's not the kind of, hey, and we're nailing Haifa every single day, you know, like in 2006 and we tried to hit an Israeli Corvette that was off the coast of Lebanon. It was not to that level. Clearly, was there? It was leveled out. The Houthis were becoming active, and you know you had all these other different factions. Yes, strategically, the game has changed. But you know, if you're looking at it, and let's say you're a Palestinian faction, yeah, it's changed for the Iranians and their benefit, and they didn't expend that many resources. And meanwhile, you know, Gaza's getting flattened because of this attack that you know you were. Like you guys, meaning you, the Iranians, were likely cheering us on to do. So I think for them, you know, how do you do this to not just demonstrate that there's some truth behind some Iranian promises, but I also think it had hit that point where it's kind of like, okay, well, you look, we did our big thing. We can do that. You know, we sent the message and all right, we're going to slink back now. Because, you know, frankly, I would make the argument that Iran, and it's unfortunate, I think American policymakers in part, a lot of European policymakers already do this anyway, but Iran really practices kind of this, they live in this kind of house of mirrors. And, you know, they project a very, very strong game. And I think a lot of people buy the wrong pieces of that projection. And then kind of like, yeah, but we don't want to deal with this. And yeah, but you know, let's be a little, yeah, let's de-escalate, whatever that means. And the Iranians will test every single time. And so, you know, you get these kinds of actions where it's like, okay, well, no, we didn't really expect all that much. Well, how'd this happen? Well, I mean, it clearly fits with their game plan. And I will say this, initially, I didn't think the attack would be that big. Frankly, when I was interviewed by a few different places, I was saying, look, you know, we need to look at other kind of soft targets that they could possibly hit, other demonstrations of what they could do. I was convinced they were going to use drones, maybe even ballistic missiles at some point. But I didn't really think it was going to be kind of the you know, that big that big push that they tried to execute. Now, on a side note, I'm sorry I'm getting ahead and like jumping around and stuff, but
no, you're good.
There's something kind of going on here too. You know, there were, you said, what was it? Like it was 120 rockets that were launched.
170 drones, 30 cruise missiles, 120 ballistic missiles.
Okay. So, you know, the numbers, when you're looking at this, I mean, the Iranians claimed it was like 300 of all sorts that were thrown up there.
Yeah.
Something a lot of people are not mentioning is the amount of failure that occurred with these launches.
Right.
Now, needless to say, that's some amount of failure is going to happen. But I do find it interesting, you know, that occurred not because of interdiction by American, British, Israeli, Saudi, Jordanian, you name it. Forces that occurred because, well, the Iranians, you know, often have kind of a faulty setup and a faulty apparatus, and not everything is perfect. But it also demonstrates that, you know, they were in this to cause some level of damage. I think by the seat of their pants, by luck, kind of like after they responded to Qasem Soleimani getting killed and they launched a number of ballistic missiles at U.S. forces in Iraq. It's by the grace of God that, you know, more Americans were not killed. It's the same thing that goes with a lot of their attacks in Syria and Iraq. Their attacks are aimed to kill people. They have payloads to kill people. And I think, you know, sometimes that the slight level of incompetence or maybe just poor machinery didn't allow for that. You know, I think the argument that, well, it was all planned and executed in the background, I don't fully buy that at all. I don't really think that's the case. I'm sure a number of signals were sent by the Americans. I'm sure a number of signals were sent by European entities and also by Middle Eastern ones. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think, you know, the Iranians both lucked out that it didn't kill more people, because if you look at the Israeli response, it was kind of like what they do when they call the roof knocking, kind of like, oh, we're warning you before we bomb the building because we also want you to know that we know where your guy is. And we want to kind of send a deeper signal. The Israelis essentially did that by, you know, knocking out an advanced SAM site right where, you know, their nuclear facilities are. But I mean, that could have spun into something quite different. But I also think that part of the calculus by the Iranians is that they don't really care if it does. I know that sounds really counterintuitive, but I think, well, if it happens, it happens. It's the grace of God, it happened. And, you know, we got to deal with that. But I get the impression that a lot of the munitions that were aimed at the Israelis, you know, they knew what a certain end effect would be, you know, because everything had been telegraphed beforehand. But if it happened to kill 10 Israelis, well, you know, that's how it worked. I know it sounds kind of crazy. It's just, I think, you know, two opposing things can be true. And I think that's kind of how the Iranians have done that.
You taught me a while ago that if you want to understand the Iranians' intentions, what they're trying to say, what they're trying to accomplish through any particular kind of operation or act, pay close attention to A, the proxies that they activate when they do so, B, the hardware that they pull out to do it, whether that's unveiling some sort of a new weapon system or something. I think a lot of observers, myself included, and maybe you here too, really just sort of expected the response to be limited to maybe Syrian proxy groups or IRGC units in Syria firing at Israeli units inside the Golan. So for listeners, the Golan Heights, it's a sliver of land sort of between Israel and Syria, right around the Sea of Galilee, captured by Israel in the Six-Day War, 1967, is claimed by Syria. It's disputed. I sort of figured that they would, looking at that kind of retaliatory, escalatory issue, right, that you mentioned before, that they would focus their response to the Golan Heights and not attack Israel proper. But a combined strike package of 300 missiles and drones fired at Israel itself, that's a significant response. So you're saying they didn't just, it wasn't all for show, that they really intended to do some damage here or didn't care if they did or didn't.
Well, there was clear calculation of the targets they picked, or at least the ones that we know that they picked. So there can be a calculation that, all right, certain, you know, maybe no one's going to die from these, but it can demonstrate our mettle and, you know, how we can execute things. But if you're launching that many, I hate this term suicide drone. It's just so stupid. But, you know, if you're launching the quote unquote suicide drones and they're falling over all over Jerusalem, there's kind of a high chance that, you know, they're going to not hit a military target. There's a high chance that they could kill someone. There's also a high chance, and this is the other interesting calculation here. You know, we're talking about how the Saudis and UAE joined in. And I'm sorry to take this on a different direction. I promise I'll revisit what you were saying earlier. But that, you know, and they joined and they were, you know, it's essentially taken as, and they were defending the Israelis. Yes and no. And the no part is, one, you've had groups like the Houthis and you've had Iraqi Shia militias that have launched and also threatened UAV attacks, yeah, rocket attacks, and they've executed them. And, you know, this was happening for the past couple of years. Again, not as many people were paying attention to it because it's, you know, it's like how Syria kind of ebbed in the news, you know, who's really following the Saudi war in Yemen. But that had happened and they have an air defense. And also the aircraft and missiles were flying over their territory.
Yeah, they had to pass through their airspace, yeah, to get to Israel. So yeah, it's not.
It's like normal. It's like a normal response. Yeah. That aside, think of it this way. Well, given there was a huge rate of failure from some of these missiles and from some of these UAVs, well, what happened if one of them just kind of fell near Abu Dhabi and ended up killing some people? I mean, you have to think about that in terms of the calculation.
Yeah.
I mean, I a few colleagues that were putting up, well, it kind of demonstrates what happens when you put a bunch of radicals who are incompetent, that maybe this wasn't 100% thought through, and maybe the reaction had to be kind of emotional like this, because you have to demonstrate that you can do it. We've been pushed against the wall. How else can we respond? We have to show that we can launch 300 rockets and cruise missiles and UAVs at the Israelis, and we have to just keep doing this because everyone keeps saying, don't think they don't read Twitter. They do. You know, we have to kind of do something and demonstrate, you know, this shocking power. I mean, there's different ways of executing that. And this is one of those ways to say, and it's markedly different than how the Iranians have done it before. Again, Iran was directly involved with it. That was, you know, big thing. But they did also, you know, you brought this up before, the proxy groups that were involved, you can tell a lot from there. Well, they were threatening, a lot of the imagery was going up. They were saying, you know, UAVs, they were going to do a UAV type attack. They were kind of showing the typical stuff for like Tel Aviv's burning, right, that kind of thing. It was nothing really all that.
They did get a shot of missiles flying over, yeah, the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, which you and I both know will be in propaganda materials for the rest, yeah, of time.
Well, actually, when that happened, the minute that went up, I had actually put it up on Twitter and I was like, yep, they're going to be using this for the next 100 years. And they did. Like, yeah, immediately they used that. I mean, there's other pieces to this. I don't, you know, I think whenever you look at, this comes with any country that's executing, you know, a form of kind of complex attack or strategy, you know, there are a multitude of different things that they can get out of it. The Iranians are pretty good at capitalizing on things for propagandistic needs. And a lot of it's really driven by that. You know, you'll see attacks that never happened and yet they have claims, you know, that, oh, and we did this, you know, and the other bit that they'll do, it's like, you know, we actually killed 100 Americans during that, you know, during that ballistic missile attack, and they're lying, right, about it. Meanwhile, simultaneously behind the scenes, yeah, we're really glad, wink, wink, that we didn't get anyone. Like, they'll say this to American policymakers and then they'll say to their own guys, we totally wanted to get 100. You know what? Launch that Shahed 129 at them and do a full payload in the nose cone. And if it doesn't, you know, try to kill them. But you know what? Don't kill too many. It's so odd and kind of weirdly contradictory. But I think in part, you know, it's for them, it's kind of a reading of both American weakness. And again, this isn't like a partisan comment. It's just they've literally tried this. They test with every single president who comes in one way or another. And particularly since the Iran deal stuff with Obama, to kind of see what the reaction is going to be. What are they going to do? And what happens if this happens? Well, you know, if we really get hit hard, well, maybe we back up a little bit. Maybe we just kind of keep it on a very, very slow burn. You know, we have to constantly show that we can do something. So I think in part, you know, this is what happens when you're dealing with a rather aggressive, outwardly focused regime in Tehran. But then you're also dealing with kind of an America that is, you know, it's resigned itself, like the Middle East is screwed. You know, what are we going to do? And then you have other domestic issues that are going on here. You have other issues with the Israelis. There's a high level of complexity that for the average voter, they're like, what the hell is a Houthi? You know, what is this? And I mean, I think all of that's kind of culminating in this type of response strategy that the Iranians did.
Yeah, we're going to take a quick break and then we'll be right back with more. I want to get back to that rate of failures with the drones and the missiles in a second there, but just to wind it back to the strike on Zahedi, this, of course, follows a number of strikes on IRGC operational figures in Lebanon and Syria over the past few years, several of which happened since October 7th. Okay, so in the intro, I said, you know, this is like sort of, but not really, the first time that Israel and Iran have attacked each other directly. You kind of had a face there, and I agree with you that it's not, but this is the first time, I guess, that it was maybe telegraphed 2 weeks in advance and covered like live on CNN as it happened, right? What was so significant for the Iranians about that airstrike in Damascus that caused them to respond in the significant way that they did? Was it just like they've been losing guys for months and years since Soleimani and the org chart is just getting hacked to pieces and, you know, we can't stand it anymore? Okay, Zahedi's gone, you know, we got to hit him hard this time. Or was it more that they hit a diplomatic facility and they had to save face somehow?
Well, hold on. I mean, let's not turn this into a black or white. I mean, I think there's a few reasons here. One, okay. I mean, I think the claims that this is a diplomatic facility, and they kept honing that. Uh-huh. One, the irony of that statement coming from the Iranians is so classic. Sure. I don't even know where to go with it. I just like the endless list of diplomatic yeah. facilities that their proxies and they have assisted in attacking is like through the roof. Again, that doesn't.
Right. The U.S. Embassy in Baghdad repeatedly.
It doesn't mean attacking diplomatic facilities is now all okay. But the other thing is, I mean, if you're looking at the strike itself hit a building that was next door to it. Was it within that annex? Again, I don't know. I'd been down that street once in my life. And this was like 2008 or 9. I'm trying to remember. It's like years and years and years ago. So my memory on it is pretty cracked on that one. But, you know, the Canadians were down the street, the old Canadian yeah. embassy. But again, with the Iranians, they operate a bunch of different annexes that are close. I mean, they have annexes that are all over Sayyida Zainab, a shrine, a religious shrine, that are next to it, within it. They have Hezbollah meetings that are going on within the grounds of a religious building. You know, so you have kind of issues like that, too. But knowing the Iranians and the way that they craft things, how do you make the Israelis look even worse, you know, because the evil, hated Zionist enemy? Well, mm-hmm. and look, they attacked a diplomatic facility. Again, I say it with kind of some irony, but also it works propagandistically, whether it is true or not. Again, it's immaterial whether it's true or not. It will work to push an Iranian goal of the Israelis. Look at them. They're unhinged and they just keep attacking. And, you know, we're trying to de-escalate. Right. Don't you see? Even though they, you know, just launched rockets the day before.
It reinforces a narrative.
Yes, it helps reinforce the narrative. But then there is that org chart issue that you're talking about. Well, yeah, they've been taking loss after loss after loss. And it's not just that. It's also, you know, the Israelis have, I think I've lost count. I can't even record half of it. And some of them aren't even reported where yeah. they were airstrikes in Syria. And, you know, you can interview a few people, you can talk to a few people here in the West, you talk to a few people out there, and, you know, a million people, a million different views. And, you know, it wasn't just that the commanders are getting knocked off, but you're also losing high-end equipment. And it doesn't mean, you know, the Iranians have it. I mean, the Shahed 129 drone, for instance, is literally using an upped lawnmower engine. It has a lot of components that you need to buy illegally and kind of get stuff in there. But, you know, let's be honest here, you know, it's an extremely upgraded, combat-worthy model plane. That's really what you're dealing with some newer sensors and some other stuff on it. You know, it's not the same as the Israelis pretty much hitting every precision guided missile transfer and missile guidance transfer that's going on to get to Lebanon and get to Hezbollah, so that the eventual kind of big conflict and the big hits and the big kind of like what happened in 2006 when Nasrallah was on TV and said there will be, that I'm going to fulfill a sacred promise to you that the Israelis will be hit in a way that you won't even know. And then right as that was going on, the INS Hanit was hit with like a Su-802 missile.
It was a silkworm, yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, you look at something like that and it's kind of like, well, they're degrading that. They are degrading our command and control. We are trying to capitalize. And I'm talking as if I'm Iranian. We are trying to maintain a good level of control and influence on Palestinian factions. It's going to be very, very hard for us to resupply, given we have no idea how the Israelis are going to deal with Gaza in the future. Hezbollah, we can't fully unleash. One, because they might not actually be completely ready. Two, we don't know what, you know, equipment is like because they've nailed a lot of the shipments in. We don't know if this will give the Israelis an opportunity to essentially wipe out Hezbollah because we don't want to lose mm-hmm. that jewel in the crown. You have a bunch of different things here. So if I'm transmitting this to the world, you know, of course, there's a great way of playing what they call cry bully, online. You know, it's the, I can't believe that you slapped me in the face. Well, you literally just spit in my eye. It's like, what do you want?
Yeah.
But I mean, that's part of diplomacy with pretty much every country plays that at some point or another. But, yeah. You know, the Iranians are quite skilled at it. Yeah, but I think in that case, it's kind of showing the, could you believe this? How dare you hit commanders that are totally involved with this war that's also going on in your country? I had no idea. And it's in a different country. Can't you see? Because they know that it'll resound in certain places. And I think that's part of that calculation. But there's another piece to it, too, where you're having the IRGC itself is not a moderate institution. Okay. It is an institution within Iran, but it has extraordinarily extreme goals. And it's interesting, those goals were also paralleling with other things going on domestically within Iran. For instance, they were putting the Shador, the kind of the hijab restrictions, and beating women and hauling them off to jail at the same time that these attacks against the Israelis are going. And if you know anything about Khomeinist ideology and kind of the descendants of Khomeini and their ideology with Khamenei and the IRGC, then, you know, obviously these women who are unclothed, that's part of that Zionist influence. And so you were hitting it all at the same time. I know it sounds completely ludicrous, but again, it's, you know, you look back at Khomeinist writings, like the first page of Wilayat al-Faqih, the Islamic government, now it's called Islamic governance. The first line talks about how it's really the Jews that are pulling all the strings, and the Jews did it. And that's why, you know, the Jews are trying to destroy Islam. And that's totally why we need to do this. And it's just interesting. It's like, okay, there might be a little piece in there that they're kind of ideologically fighting that ideological war that fits within that paradigm. And then meanwhile, we're looking at it here going, wow, there's so much going on. Why does it dovetail with that? I have no idea. Anyway, there are pieces of that attached too. So you can even argue, you know, within the IRGC, hey, we've lost enough guys. We are listening to ideologically our leader, the supreme leader, and maybe he wants something different. It was interesting. I'm sorry, I'm going down so many rabbit holes, but it was interesting. I saw there was a lot of commentary going on there that Khamenei is really taking a more moderate position. Okay, well, what led you to say that? Well, he had a few comments here there. Well, no, like many Shia clerics, there's a statement that can be read many different ways. And often it's deliberate to either hide your opinion, to push another opinion, or to do a multitude of things. You know, and I got the impression from a lot of his statements that was kind of playing that ground where, well, I'll see where the centers of power are at the end of the day. And if we have to launch this big attack, maybe I don't want to do it, but there's, you know, I have to keep a balance somehow. But I did notice that quite a bit, like unequivocally, people who don't read, you know, the Persian language press or the Arabic language press or anything else, just like, you know, he doesn't really want to do that attack. Okay, maybe not. Or maybe he's saying that publicly to offer a conflicting message, which the Iranians constantly do. For instance, saying in English, we had nothing to do with October 7th to American diplomats and to other diplomats overseas, while, you know, in all of their newspapers and all of their propaganda publications saying, we totally did it. We were totally involved. Here's the weapon systems that we gave to them. And look at the training we gave. You know, it's...
Yeah.
I mean, I think we run into a problem with a lot of that. And I think we have the same issue with the consulate attack. I think, you know, given how the Iranians were executing things and it was widely considered kind of weak and standoffish, that, you know, they wanted to have a big show both internally and also for certain external elements that are kind of within their orbit. And I think that's kind of why it filtered down in this way. I think, you know, it might have been a one too many for them, given his key place, especially with Lebanese Hezbollah. I get the impression that there was a lot going on. There was a lot going on, and there had to be some form of response. Again, I will repeat this. I thought that response would be one different, meaning, you know, the UAVs and stuff would be launched a different way. But it totally makes sense what they did. And again,
it did.
And I've said this before. I mean, I said it on Twitter a bunch of times that, you know, they will kind of tell you modes of execution and what they want to do. And well, one of those things that they telegraphed was, okay, we're going to have a mass rocket attack and drones, and you're going to be under the weight of these new systems that Iran can bring to the table. Well, okay. Well, that they wanted to demonstrate it, and they pretty much did.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about the rate of failure in the drones and missile systems that the Iranians sent up here. Do you think, yeah, that rate of failure, to say nothing of the ease with which Israel, the U.S., and its coalition partners knocked down the rest of it. Do you think they were surprised by that? And did that maybe play a role to keep them from escalating it further in the third or fourth round of strikes?
No, I mean, I think they were just going to do this one round. And I think, again, don't get me wrong, like if the Israelis were on their knees and really getting pummeled, I'm sure they'd try to do something else because the opportunity has come up and why not take advantage of it? I mean, clearly we're being sent a divine message that they're weak. But I do think, again, so much was telegraphed beforehand. So much of it was.
Like, yeah.
People knew something was going to happen. You kind of knew within 48 hours. And then, oh my God, it happened within that 48-hour window. That it would be hard to say, you know, if they tried doing even more, I think for them, you know, okay, we sent our signal and we can, you know, hold our own, you know, with the Israelis, and we feel good at least internally that we've demonstrated we could do that. I don't know, honestly, like if it just occurred like now and then they just kept doing it. One, I mean, what are the stocks looking like for them in terms of how many right. UAVs and missiles, cruise missiles and other rockets that they're deploying? Then I guess the other pieces to it as well, it's the, okay, well, how long do you want to keep this going for? And do you really want to look, is it worthy to you to look a certain way internationally? And I think maybe some pieces of that kind of chimed in with it. It was interesting because one of the narratives that was taken on a lot of Western news channels was, you know, wow, here the Israelis are, you know, diplomatically isolated and people are tagging them for how they've executed their operations in Gaza. And here are the Iranians who just came through at the worst possible time and have now, you know, put the shoe on the other foot. I mean, so there might actually be some strategic calculation that came to that as well. But again, I mean, it's not like the attacks have stopped. I mean, I think people forget this. It's not like, you know, Hezbollah has stopped. It's not like Hamas is stopping. You know, there's a lot of other things that are going on. But I can say I doubtful that, you know, unless the Israelis were like literally on the floor, that they would have really kind of gone beyond that. I mean, I think this was broadcast a little too widely for it to be, you know, kind of, hey, we're going to have 300 drones every day. You know, it's not
right.
Not going to work that way.
So the Lebanon issue, at least in his public statements since October 7th, Hassan Nasrallah has pretty strongly suggested that he doesn't want the smoke, to put it a certain way. Meanwhile, there are still 70,000 Israelis evacuated from towns in northern Israel along the Lebanese border. There's been some reports in the latter half of this month that the Israelis are considering maybe some sort of a preemptive attack on Hezbollah in Lebanon. How do you feel about that? Do you think it's likely? Do you expect it? What do you think?
It's interesting. I mean, because you use the terminology that I've seen a lot, a preemptive attack on Hezbollah. Well, Hezbollah's already attacked them. No,
yes.
You know what
yes.
I mean? It's
yes.
Interesting how this is getting framed. You know, Hezbollah's already done it. And I think, you know, I try to analyze it from a lot of different points of view just to see where it's coming from. Hezbollah, one could make the argument that, you know, hey, we can only get so involved in this. We only have so many capabilities. We've got to worry about Syria. We've got to worry about a bunch of other stuff. We were, you know, pretty much expressly told that maybe the big conflict isn't going to happen now. We need some patience, da 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 da. Okay, here's the packages that we can deliver to the table. But there's, at the end of the day, you're looking, you're saying, you know, what was it, 70,000? There's a ton of Israelis that have been evacuated from northern Israel, and it's already hard enough for them, the Israelis, to keep those people up there. Like, there's high incentivization to keep people in towns and villages that are in northern Israel. And when Hezbollah is literally launching these short-range Katyushas, that's another issue here. You know, there's a lot of talk about, well, you know, the Iron Dome and the, you know, whatever the new, like, David's Arrow. What's the, it's like the Arrow 3.
David's Sling, yeah.
David's Sling.
Yeah.
So you look at that, but most of those systems, and Iron Dome, while it's marketed as like for a short-range rocket systems, well, they're kind of expensive. Whereas a 107 millimeter rocket, like, or a, you know, Katyusha 122, like Grad, you know, those things don't cost all that much. You can make them in your garage, you know, if you've got the right.
And they do.
But I mean, you look at something like that and, okay, well, the cost benefit analysis says, how much money is this going to cost? And by the way, Hezbollah and a lot of the Iraqi proxies and Bahraini proxies, all of them have come out. It's interesting how they will market this kind of, we know how beholden to money, you know, the evil ones, our enemies are. And they'll put up stuff like, hey, we destroyed this like convoy of Humvees. That cost the Americans this much. You know, they won't even put up how much they spent, but obviously it's less if you're, you know, piling in a bunch of plastic explosives and shoving them somewhere on the road. You know, it's much less expensive to what's that's costing, you know, quote unquote, the occupation forces. So, I mean, I think there's a piece of that that's in their calculation. The other thing is, a lot of these anti, you know, the anti-ballistic missile, anti-rocket systems, all of that stuff, it not just costs money, but also has only certain effectiveness. It's not as effective when it comes to the smaller rockets that are cheaply produced and, you know, and they're launched in droves. And so, you know, you have to deal with attacks like that. And then combine that with a few key operations that Hezbollah has done, like where they've attacked a center where the Israeli military was gathering. I think this was about a month ago.
Oh, yeah, that was near the border, right?
It was near the border.
Yeah.
But you look at that and it's kind of, it's interspersed with these more organized, kind of highly detailed, and a lot of intelligence work went into organizing an attack like that. And then you have other little kind of pinprick bits like, oh, hey, we're going to nail all the sensors on, you know, on the border.
Right. Raptors testing the fences.
I mean, essentially, that's essentially what it comes down to. And, you know, I would say if you look at that from an Israeli perspective, and you're seeing this in the press quite a bit, and the Israeli press and also with oppositional political figures, it's the, you know, we screwed stuff up in 2006. It's interesting how they never look back at 1982. They talk about 2006 now. It's like interesting how memory has just faded. But they look at 2006 and they're saying, you know what? We should have stayed there longer. And we could have just destroyed Hezbollah, at least in the south. There were a ton of issues with even that thinking. Because if, like, Jonathan Randall wrote this book back in, let's say, like 1985, called Going All the Way. And Going All the Way, he was a journalist in Beirut. Going All the Way was the Israelis going all the way to Beirut, you know, and
yeah.
Working with Christian allies that were there and trying to get, you know, a Christian politician elected. Anyway,
I just want to give some context here, Philip. Sorry. So
sure.
For listeners, and correct me here or add more details if you would like to, Philip. So the Israelis invaded Lebanon in 1982 to unseat the PLO. So that's Yasser Arafat's organization that was at that point headquartered in Beirut. That's why they went into Lebanon. Their occupation of parts of Lebanon, which continued up until, what, 2000, right?
Yeah. April 2000, or May.
Right. That occupation is what Hezbollah was created in response to.
No. Fair. Well, I'll get the little details. So in part, yes, from 1978, they did an invasion south of Litani called the Litani Operation, literally called the Litani Operation because it went to the Litani River. Then in 1982, it was Operation Peace for the Galilee. And then they went pretty much all the way to Beirut. In part, it was to get the PLO out of Lebanon. And then the other part was also some political games that were going on where they wanted Bashir Gemayel, who was kind of main leader within the Kataib party, to help get elected because they thought maybe a peace treaty could come out and maybe you kind of push up kind of Christian leadership there and they'll be more friendly to the Israelis. They didn't like the Syrians. They didn't like the PLO. But then Hezbollah was actually in the works for a while. And I think it's interesting because I think it's now become so ingrained in how people tell the story of the group that, well, it was in response to the Israelis. No, it was in response to the Islamic Revolution in Iran. You had clerics that were actually, they knew Khomeini. They were in the Dawah party, which Khomeini was also part of. And they wanted to essentially initially create an Islamic government in the Khomeinist style in Lebanon. And they saw that as an opportunity, just like the Israeli occupation that was there. Yes, they were there to oppose the Israeli occupation, obviously, for a lot of reasons. But there are other kind of pieces that are tied in with it. You know, I'm sorry. Again, I'm doing like the weird nuance.
You're good. This will be a longer one. And I think that's good. Let's give the people all the details, stuff to chew on here.
Well, it is important to remember because I think a lot of people, I'm using a lot of very Trumpian, you know, yeah, a lot of people say.
Many people are saying.
Yeah, many people are saying. But it's, you know, it is kind of true, even in academic circles where it's the, well, they were formed in response to the Israeli occupation. Okay. One part of that is, but they, you know, in their founding document, 1985, this is when the Israelis had pulled away from Beirut and were just occupying, the South,
right.
The South Lebanon army, you know, they stated they wanted an Islamic state of Lebanon. That's what they wanted, an Islamic Republic of Lebanon. And they looked to Khomeini, and they still look to Khomeini and the leadership of Khamenei in Iran as supreme leader. So that has never changed. Like in 2009, for instance, they They had this reformed manifesto. But meanwhile, it didn't say that, hey, we've dropped this whole absolute with Ayatollah Faqih thing, which is their transnational ideology. And, you know, having Khamenei as the supreme leader and having kind of the same religious ideological framework that went along with it. So, yeah, it was a multifold deal.
Yeah.
I love how I'm sorry, I went in such a tangent that we've completely lost what I was even getting at for going all the way.
You were talking about going all the way, going all the way to Beirut in 2006, right? To put an end to Hezbollah.
What they were saying was, you know, we should have gone back to the old situation of we should have occupied a chunk of South Lebanon, kicked Hezbollah out, and then we can find a way to, you know, either renegotiate or you occupy it or whatever. Like, it's just, for me, I kind of look at that and it's like, step one, take over Southern Lebanon. Step two, question mark. Step three, profit. You know, it's
right. Underpants gnomes. Yeah.
But it's, you know, I kind of look at that and it's the, okay, well, that still leaves Lebanese Hezbollah in the Baqa Valley for the most part, which is where they formed. It doesn't get rid of their main transport networks that go through Syria. But what it would do is, and this is kind of a major thing, if you look at kind of this weird kind of dichotomy that's forming, it would be very hard, I'm not saying impossible, but very hard to pop off those 107s and 122 millimeter rockets. Yes, do they have the range? Yeah, but it gives you extra time if they're launching it from like Nablatia compared to if they're launching it from like Ramesh. Ramesh is all the way on the border with Israel. It's a Christian town. Nablatia is a main town that's, it's in southern Lebanon, but it's up a bit more.
I'm just thinking like, the idea that, like, you know, in 2006, they should have stayed and occupied part of southern Lebanon to, you know, establish more of a buffer, I guess, force a disarmament there. But I mean, in a way, they did that up until 2000. And at least on paper, that's what UNIFIL is supposed to be for, the UN peacekeeping force. I mean, and it's
UNIFIL's on paper to do a lot of things.
Right.
Have they done it? No, because
no.
You've had UNSCR 1559 and 1701, and both have essentially called for disarming militias that are in that area. Now, that's not just Lebanese Hezbollah, but Lebanese Hezbollah is obviously the largest and the big coordinator. When UNIFIL has even, like, when the UN has gone out of its way when it's come to, let's say, certain politicians being killed in Lebanon, it's interesting how UNIFIL convoys will get surrounded by these random partisans who are protesting. I put that in quotes. They're just protesting UNIFIL's presence, even though UNIFIL has been in the area for God knows how long. And also simultaneously, those same, you know, types of protesters also will talk about how the Israelis deliberately target UNIFIL that's down there too, as kind of another, you know, bludgeoning point. But it's like fascinating. UNIFIL is there. And I think there are strong arguments to say, well, this is done. This isn't working. But there's also strong arguments to say, okay, then what takes over in the meantime? Like what else is there as a monitor, and what else is there as kind of another, you know, pressure point? I don't know. I look at it and it's kind of like, well, if their job was to enforce 1559 and 1701, cool, they're going to get nailed with a bunch of EFPs that Lebanese Hezbollah pulls out. That's, you know, Hezbollah's already threatened it. They will never turn over their arms because they are the Islamic resistance. Hooray for them. And, you know, the Israelis also simultaneously are like, yeah, they're completely useless and they don't do anything. And, you know, what's the deal? But, you know, they're there. But again, it's, you know, UNIFIL's goals have not really been met at all.
No.
And then beyond that, it's also, you know, the Israeli occupation of the South, the argument for, you know, why would they want to occupy the South and stay there for, you know, an extended period would be, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that was written in the early 2000s about this that was from kind of the flip side of, well, you know, the security zone was evacuated. And look what ended up happening. The proxy forces that the Israelis used, meaning the South Lebanon Army, completely disintegrated. And you had, you know, a couple thousand Lebanese fleeing into Israel, you know. But one of the big things was Hezbollah was unable to really, and this is, you know, according to the Israeli experts and Israeli policymakers who were on the side of, no, we need to maintain the security zone. You know, they weren't really all that effective when it came to targeting the Israelis. A lot of these attacks would be kind of cordoned off in the South Lebanon security zone. And then if you add on to that, I brought up the SLA before. Well, you know, there is a skeleton force of Israelis of about like 1,000 to 2,000 guys, whereas the SLA was, you know, at its smallest anywhere from like 1,500 to 2,000 guys. And, you know,
can I give some more context here?
Sure.
So the SLA that you're referring to, that's the South Lebanon Army.
Yes.
That was a Israeli-backed militia up until 2000.
Yeah, it was. So in 1975-ish, it was started in part by Saad Haddad, who was in the Lebanese armed forces. He was based in Marjayoun, which is a southern Christian town. It had a good amount of Christians that were in it. It was mostly Christian leadership. Later was taken over by Antoine Lahad, who was also SLA commander. It had its own intelligence apparatus, had its own kind of quasi-social services, and it was deeply connected with the Israelis through the good fence, through kind of like certain border checkpoints that they had with the Israelis. So they were kind of closely integrated. And also they kind of ran their own system down there. But the way the Israelis executed the pullout, and this is under Ehud Barak, who essentially announced it in 1999. He's like, yeah, we're going to be out of there by 2000, which, you know, what did Hezbollah do? Hezbollah actually, you know, started to try to kill certain key leaders that were like involved with the SLA and stuff, which you just caused them to totally disintegrate by, you know, by the time, you know, the Israelis were pulling out. But anyway, to kind of get back on to the, like what the SLA was, at that time, you had a proxy militia force that also was pretty well-funded, well-equipped, well-trained. They were doing their jobs. And, you know, for the Israelis anyway. And there's a disintegration of that. Do you expect that's going to be magically rebuilt by the Israelis? No, they're not going to trust that. It's not going to happen. But I mean, that's just like issue number one. Issue number two is, okay, so cool. Where are we drawing the line for where South Lebanon is? Because I've read a number of articles that have said right at the Litani River. Cool. Well, the Litani River goes all the way to Baalbek. But so let's think about thinking critically, where is it going to go? And then also, what do you do with Hezbollah after you've pushed them out of the south? Do you just leave them there as this kind of, you know, metastasized cancer for you that's just kind of sitting up there and launching attack? Like, how does that work? Because it seems like a lot of this talk really comes down to we're rightfully, again, I can understand it from the Israeli position. We are rightfully bothered by the 107 millimeters, 122, the grads. It's just interesting post that, but then there's a ton of other things that you kind of have to address and you have to deal with acting as an occupying force down there again. You know, there's also the population issue. Let's say you conquer it all the way to Sur, which is Tyre. That's if nobody evacuates, and I'm sure a lot of people would evacuate, but if no one evacuates, that's like 200,000 people that live in the Tyre area. The Israelis just going to kind of, you know, execute that. I mean, I know that they did during the Lebanese Civil War when they went in there during Operation Peace for the Galilee, but you're dealing with a very, very different setup than you've got now. It's like it's night and day.
I mean, just my personal view of it, I don't know. I think the situation for post-war Gaza has yet to be kind of decided, but I do not see the Israeli public as having the appetite to occupy both Gaza and some portion of southern Lebanon. It just doesn't seem feasible to me.
I don't know. I mean, I think time will tell more than anything else, but I think you have Israelis that now feel like they're against the wall on a lot of stuff, both with Gaza, with international opinion, and like all this other kind of stuff going on where, you know, I talked to, it's interesting, you know, I spoke to an Iraqi militia guy, and then I also spoke to an Israeli friend. So it was hilarious to kind of, you know, the two different views and weird stuff that was going on and you know, what's actually going on with Gaza. And you know, the Israeli view that I kind of constantly hear is one of, did they not see that, you know, for the Israelis, did they not see that we got massacred on October 7th, that we're trying to execute this war, we're trying to do this, we're trying to do that. You know, they're holding our hands behind our backs. You know, we're dealing with rocket attacks all the time. It's just like treated like this is normal and no one cares. And even America is annoyed. Like, what right do they have? And I think in part, you know, given it's what, almost 6 months since October 7th, it was 6 months.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's still burning quite hot with a lot of Israelis, but so was 1978 and 1982. You know, those same time periods, you know, we are under attack. What are we going to do here? We can change the balance of power in the Middle East. If we go all the way there, we can also get rid of the PLO, which was an issue for us. You know, why not sweep it clean? And so it's a lot of these things initially sound great. And sometimes they sound great on paper. If you're an Israeli, you're like, I'm pissed. I'm sick of dealing with this crap. And then you have to deal with the other 10 years of all the other, you know, the other kind of heartburn that kind of comes with it. And I think it's that kind of position of, you know, how much agita are you willing to deal with? I think that's kind of where Israelis would kind of get sick and tired and annoyed with it. And then the other thing is, you know, I looking at it from the other point of view, from let's say an Iranian proxy point of view, I think the argument can be made that it is very, very easy for Hezbollah to actually get some new wind in its sails, even if it loses a ton of guys and loses a lot of stuff. But it can get a good kind of narrative blow if, you know, you now have an occupying Israeli force in Lebanon. Because what happens then? And I'm not saying, again, like we run into this problem where it's the, well, if only, you know, there are plenty of people in Lebanon who don't like Lebanese Hezbollah. This is very true. In fact, there's a ton of them who hate Lebanese Hezbollah. But then what happens if the Israelis now have taken over southern Lebanon? Will some just like not care and say, well, they did this, you know, Hezbollah did this to themselves? Yeah, I'm sure some will. But it's very, very easy to kind of engender this, hey, you see, the resistance is still here. And we were defending the Palestinians. And look what these Israelis did, to just cause this new round of just, you know, more agita. It doesn't really allow for, you know, kind of an end strategic goal of, you know, of Hezbollah kind of either learning its lesson or being, you know, pigeonholed in some direction. I'm not saying that that's even effective either, but, you know, it puts Hezbollah and the Israelis in a weird position, and puts the Iranians also in another weird position. And frankly, I think the Iranians and Lebanese Hezbollah would know how to capitalize on it in some form to at least kind of win out and make people forget, you know, all the other things that they had done in previous years, you know, from killing Christians to killing Sunnis in Syria to killing Sunnis in Lebanon to causing all sorts of problems and economic issues in Lebanon. There's an occupation here and let's capitalize on it. And you'll forget because that's how politics moves. I always see that as a risk for Israeli policymakers. But again, I mean, I think a lot of Israeli policymakers are coming up with kind of the, what else do you expect us to do? So it's crazy. You're literally between a rock and a hard place, and they're just all bad solutions. Let's choose the least worst.
All the heartburn that their post-October 7th strategic position gives them aside, it, and correct me here if I'm wrong, it sounds like you're saying that you feel that the Israelis trying to occupy southern Lebanon again would be a bad idea.
I think, again, it takes long-term planning and kind of also thinking through the possibilities of what they can actually execute and what they can do and how effective that's going to be for how long. And I think, you know, a lot of people who throw that out there, and again, a lot of, you know, Israeli policymakers or at least politicians, and again, politicians only, you know, mean so much when they say something, but I just get the impression that's the, you know, you're sick of rockets. We're going to get rid of those rockets. Cool. Okay. The way you're doing it is, you know, there are long-term constraints that you now have that you have to operate within. And no one seems to be addressing this. And the reaction you get is, well, we've already thought about that. Okay. Like everyone thought about that in 1982. Again, not saying that it's not coming from a place of, we've now been pushed against the wall. What other options do we have? It's why I can't say it's entirely good or entirely bad. Again, I'm also not an Israeli policymaker. I'm an American number one, and I just kind of watch the stuff. But I mean, I can see why there's some level of consternation. Two, I can also see where, you know, longer term planning really needs to go into it and how that can go completely haywire. And three, I mean, I think some of the people who are kind of out there who, and I read one article recently, it was like, you know, Israel should just change the borders and annex everything up to the Litani. Huh? What?
Yeah. You can just do that.
That was one of them out there. And I get it from a messaging angle, from a rhetorical angle.
Sykes-Picot went so great the first time.
Well, I mean, part of the argument on this one is, well, you know, Lebanon and Israel's, and at least mandate Palestine's borders were defined later on, you know, by the French, the British. And so who knows really what a frontier is. And, you know, Lebanese nationalists now will still discuss the seven villages that are, you know, within Israel that happen to have a Maronite population or something in it. But it's, you know, anyway, looking at that, I mean, I get it from a rhetorical side. If I were if I were in the political position there, yeah, I might send out some smoke signals like that to warn Hezbollah. But then I also think, you know, sometimes when you hear it from like normal people are like, yeah, that should be done. Well, okay, hold on. Let's think, thinking critically here and thinking clearly. I mean, I just think there's, it's like a 50-50 in terms of, you know, what's the return on the investment? You know, I worry about it from that angle. I'm just saying, I mean, by the way, I am solidly addressing kind of some form of occupation of southern Lebanon. Obviously, if an attack happened against Lebanese Hezbollah, that would have to go in concert with it. Like it would have to happen. But it's just interesting to see those talking points, but it's also, you know, is an attack worthwhile right now? And I think from a policymaker perspective, I can make the argument that Lebanese Hezbollah is in a weak position. They have been taking casualties. They've been taking some heavy losses. The Iranians have been taking some heavy losses. No one finished the goal early in 2006. Why the hell not take an opportunity like this? Why the holdup? And I can totally understand it from that position as well. And that's kind of why I'm sitting here going, okay, you want me to write a policy piece on it? Well, it's not the easiest thing to say yes or no. And I hate it because I tend to be solutions oriented. So it kind of just makes me insane if I'm trying to analyze it from either position.
I don't know, man. The logic here in favor of that, just to me, it rings a lot like us looking at Iraq after 9/11 or Putin thinking he can do a 3-day special military operation to conquer Ukraine. You know, like, great plan on paper. Yeah, sure, makes sense to, you know, get rid of this unresolved threat that we have here. But once you initiate it, you just doesn't go the way you want it to.
Well, yeah. I mean, look, that risk is always there in any military operation. You always have that risk. And what I would say is I think there's a few other pieces here that are more of an issue. So the Israelis are very air power dominated when it comes to how they execute their attacks and how they execute warfare in general. And I think what's already been seen from 2006, during the 2006 war, it was so air power heavy that, you know, people are like, well, we bombed it. And look, it's all great. Hezbollah's been wiped out. Then meanwhile, Hezbollah would kind of like pop up again. And you see this in Gaza too, occasionally, although I think it's a little bit more propagandistically focused. Oh, Hamas just popped back up over there. Yeah, well, of course they do. They have a tunnel there and it hasn't been cleared and it takes a while to clear stuff. I mean, the same argument can be made, you know, in southern Lebanon. But I think the old strategies of everything is super air power heavy and, you know, you can't... let's pause and let's wait. And that's like what the Israelis were doing. Oh, we're just going to wait here and, you know, wait for this to get cleared out. And, you know, and then you had the issues with policymakers. You know, I almost feel like it's like reading a lot of post-Vietnam books. You know, well, the generals had the right idea, but those politicians held us back. You know, it's that kind of attitude. But I mean, you did have that. You did have kind of a piece in there for, you know, that some people who are hard chargers, hey, you know, we can get into this area, we can cut Hezbollah off here. Well, you know, let's pause and let's see what, you know, what's being said, you know, politically speaking, and then also how effectively we're doing this. No, we don't need to advance towards Naqoura yet, and that's fine. You know, I think some of that, I don't know if that's been completely bred out of the Israeli system post 2006, and we can kind of see that in some form from what's going on in Gaza. Because if you look at that, again, timetables for it, it's interesting how a lot of Western analysts will say, hey, you know, if you guys executed this really quickly and went in, well, there's no way they could have executed that really quickly and just jumped right in, you know, and finished the job in 5 days. You know, it's not going to happen. But I do think that there is some lag that's going in. I think that, you know, there's some other issues that are there. It's kind of like, okay, but, you know, we went into Gaza. One of the issues is get back the hostages. Okay, well, some hostages were rescued, but the majority of them are not. They're still in captivity. What are the other end goals? You know, there have been maps that have shown, you know, of kind of splitting Gaza in half, where the Israelis wanted to put kind of maybe a buffer zone or maybe something else in the middle. Okay, so what's kind of being executed on that 6 months later? What's going on there?
Yeah.
Now imagine you're duplicating something like that, possibly for southern Lebanon, and they have tons of plans in the books, and they have tons of stuff that they've worked on. But then what's that also going to involve in maybe a year after? And I don't know if that has been entirely answered by Israel's policymakers. Maybe it never will be. Who knows?
Yeah. I mean, I think like DC's stated goal here since October 7th has been to, like, quote, avoid a regional war in the Middle East. And yeah, I mean, we have one. We've had one for a while, but I think you and I also both know it could still get a lot worse. It's the, like, the kind of scenario I deal with every day when I open up Microsoft Word. And just personally, I really hope that scenario stays in my Word doc, because it's not, it's ugly. Any other thoughts you'd like to add here before we wrap for the day?
I think bringing what you just brought up, and I'll kind of make this short. I'm sorry, I've gone down so many rabbit holes with this.
No, you're okay.
Like, haven't even fit, yep. Like, I haven't polished them off or anything. But it's, I love going back to this whole, well, we don't want an escalation. I want people to know there has been escalation after escalation after escalation after escalation after escalation. Well, we want to de-escalate. And, you know, Suzanne Maloney, she recently wrote a piece. I there were chunks of it that I like 100% agree with. Some other pieces I don't as much. And it was in Foreign Affairs. And I think one of the bigger issues here, and I, again, this goes to the killing of Zahedi, and it goes to the, you know, Iranian response. The Iranians now have a completely different self-manufactured policy standing in the region and acceptance of that standing by the United States. And it's interesting how that's just kind of flying under everyone's radar. And it's just kind of like we're acting like it's accepted. Well, really, we're against escalation. Well, hold on a second here. Escalation can mean a million different things. You may not want a larger war. And actually, maybe your enemy is a paper tiger and you really need to find certain nodes to hit. And maybe that would actually push it back a little bit more. And I don't think American policymakers, because we have no real stomach for it right now to deal with it. And, you know, American populace, I don't think wants, you know, another war in the Middle East. But there are other ways of executing this without taking this like hyper conciliatory view on the Iranians. And I feel like the Iranians, whether they have issues internally with their own proxy groups or they have issues even within IRGC or anything else, at the end of the day, they've won a massive strategic victory. And the response in part wasn't really a true demonstration of it. I mean, it was just one of many demonstrations. But I do think, you know, that going into the future is going to be an increasingly more important issue. And it's one of those slow drips. And this American acceptance of it, I think there are fissures that can happen, not just with the U.S. and the Israelis, but also with other Arab allies, too. And how they're doing things in the region. And it's just, it's something that's really stuck in my craw. But in addition to that, kind of the retaliation also is demonstrative of this change that has occurred. Well, you know, I guess we kind of have to allow, you know, the Iranians to do something, but we'll shoot down that stuff. And so don't worry about it. That's there. We've solved the problem. Well, no. Now the balance of power has changed in a different way.
I just want to follow up on that. We talked earlier about the Jordanians, the Saudis, and the Emiratis to some lesser extent spinning up to help propel this attack against Israel. And as you said, you know, it wasn't a matter of like the Jordanians like jumping in front of the bullet for Netanyahu. It wasn't that. I mean, this attack was passing through their airspace, right?
Yeah.
And as much as these Iranian systems are a threat to Israel, they're a threat to the Arab states as well. But do you think that sort of like open alliance with the United States, Western countries, Israel, Jordan, the Gulf Arabs, the way they more sort of openly coordinated and worked together to thwart a significant, large, potentially deadly Iranian attack, does that change the strategic landscape in more of a positive way here? Does that?
If we're focused on American policy and how to build up strong alliances, and if we're keeping this, I mean, Trump policy. Back in the day, Trump policy, which did the Abraham Accords and was really pushing forward a new relationship between Gulf Arab states, the state of Israel, and potentially Saudi Arabia included in this. The change has been going on for the past like 10 years. It's like drips. And then all of a sudden we've noticed, oh, they're shooting down Iranian stuff too. Oh my God.
See it on CNN. You're like, oh, cool. This is happening right now.
How'd that happen? You know?
Yeah.
But I mean, I think, you know, from an American perspective, if you're trying to kind of pull more out of the region and give more responsibility to local actors, well, yes, in large part, that is a far more effective way to do it. Is the framework there and kind of, again, more deconfliction mechanisms and other stuff? Yeah, I think some of it's been built up. I think it's good for, in some respects, to counter the Iranians. But, you know, how formalized is this? You know, and it's kind of the, like, how effective is the working process? I think it still required a large amount of American efforts to kind of keep it not just glued together, but also kind of at least the military response to it to really be effective. I mean, look, even the Brits were involved in shooting down some of the missiles. You know, it's interesting how that kind of culminated. I think, you know, Americans are very, very big on building coalitions to deal with the problem. Some level of multilateralism is quite effective, especially when you're dealing with pretty much a unilateral entity like the Iranians, you know, with their proxies, and they kind of control the guys, and that's what's going to happen. It's that on a very small scale. But again, I do wonder where it goes from here, because it's interesting. I mean, recently today, there was some report, and I think this was like a messaging kind of cue to see where it would go in the press, that Saudi Arabia was moving in the direction of normalizing relations with Israel. Well, we've heard that one a number of times. It's like almost like an evergreen post.
At least some Saudi officials said publicly that, you know, they thought that October 7th was an attempt to derail that normalization effort. Yeah. And they're determined not to let it happen.
Yeah, no, I think that there's a clear argument that could be made for that. I actually am inclined to agree that the timing of it, very obvious. I mean, I thought they were met. October 7th was the Iranians being met with catastrophic success. Wait, the paragliders did that well? You know, it's...
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's kind of where that was going. But I mean, I do think the Iranians have a vested interest for trying to derail any of that. And that's, I mean, again, this also goes back to the response that the Iranians did. I was interviewed by one newspaper, and they said, well, you know, you were mentioning that, you know, there could be, you know, attack on diplomatic facilities. I said, yeah, you know, if I were to do it, it would probably be in Bahrain. It's been threatened before. Nobody cared. But you can have that drip, drip, drip of warnings. You might have one cell of people on the ground who might do something with a drone they built, and that just shows another capability there. Or maybe they just launch it across the Persian Gulf into there where the U.S. Fifth Fleet is based, just to say, hey, screw you. I don't know. But I mean, I do think, you know, that would also deal with, hey, Bahrain has normalized relations. Interestingly, like after October 7th and with the Israelis kind of defending their interests, you know, the Bahrainis had some like floral criticisms of the Israelis, but, you know, what does that really mean at the end of the day? There's a very good working relationship between Manama and Jerusalem. So, you know, the Iranians have threatened it before. The Iranians, like, they've put out videos for these proxy groups that are, you know, showing them in computer animation form, like targeting an Israeli limousine going to the Ritz-Carlton that's there. It's quasi-surreal, but these are real things, like showing an LL plane landing in Manama and they're attacking it, you know? I mean, again, I'm misremembering chunks of this, but, you know, they were threats of attack movies.
It's like such like just fantasizing, like just just putting out their fantasies of what they would love to do.
Yeah, well, the other piece of it is also, I mean, you have that element, but then you also have the one of, wait a second, what are they actually trying to do? Because I mean, some of this stuff is laughable, where they're like showing a freighter sink. Like, we have this one propaganda image. They show a Shahed 129, a guy in a hang glider, a bunch of guys in a Jeep with a machine gun on the back, you know, and then they've got this freighter sinking that's on the other side. And well, some elements of that are quite real. Actually, all elements in one way or another are quite real. It's jokey, the image, and you kind of like go, but they've actually ended up pulling a lot of that off. And I think it's still very hard for a lot of people in the West. You know, I think it even comes down to when Westerners threaten this too, not to do the kind of reductio ad Hitlerum here, but, you know, when Hitler was saying, you know what we should totally do? We need to take over these Slavic areas and we need to wipe these places clean of those Jews. Oh, well, that's not, he's just trying to get Germany back on its feet. And, you know, that's a lot of rhetoric. Yes, you know, for his anti-Semitic base. So, I mean, you have stuff like that. And I think when you're dealing with kind of an ideological regime that really views that they are the spear point for God himself, and that they are supporting causes, and they may be quite realistic and pragmatic and cruel and crass even to their own guys. At the end of the day, they are true believers in many respects to get what they want and to kind of get this possibly ideological end goal and political end goal, no matter how ludicrous it sounds. And now imagine this, 20-something years ago, if we were to say, actually, let's take this date. On September 11th, 2001, if I were to tell you that Iran in 2024, April of 2024, is not only establishing rings around its main Arab and Israeli foes and even Kurdish foes, but that they also have built an entire army of proxy militia groups in that area, some of which have taken over different countries that we in 2003 would later, you know, liberate from Saddam Hussein. If I were to tell you that, you'd probably look at me and say, okay, how much crack did you do today, Philip? You know, we all know that they have been, you know, sanctioned and they have been cordoned off and don't worry about it. You know, how much, how, look at how time has changed. So I it's interesting how the kind of winds of change are always blowing through.
Yeah. Good point to leave it on that. Philip, where can people find more about you and your work?
You always ask me this and I always have like the answers for it. Well, you can Google my name. I've got two L's, S-M-Y-T-H, but I'm also, I'm on Twitter. Usually when I'm working on something, I don't post as much on Twitter. So don't take that as like, he's given up. He hates Twitter. I didn't post on Twitter for like 2 years, even though I had built up a lot of followers and stuff. But what I would say is Twitter is a good place to find me. You can even reach out to me if you have a question on there. I'm at Philip Smythe, one word, two L's for Philip, and then S-M-Y-T-H. You know, when we stole the name from the Irish, we screwed up the spelling and the pronunciation. but that's kind of where I am. But I've got work all over the place.
Cool. Well, we'll drop links to all that stuff in the show notes. I'll have a link to your new West Point paper that you mentioned earlier in the show. I'll have a link for that in there, too. Philip Smythe, thank you so much for coming back on. When stuff like this goes down, you know, there's no better person that I'd rather talk to.
I appreciate it. Sorry I'm not as succinct as most of the other better guests you have on.
I don't call you when I want succinct. I call you when I want to dig into this shit and get nerdy and really unpack it.
I'm going to put that on a business card. I don't call you when I want succinct. Get hired by none.
Yes. All right, man. I will talk to you soon, I'm sure, either here or elsewhere.
All right. Well, I really appreciate it. It was great talking to you about it.
Yep. Later, buddy.
Listening. This is Secrets and Spies.